You are now listening to the EU Startups Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the EU Startups Podcast. As always, I'm your host, David Senden-Garcia, the news editor here at EU Startups. Today, I chatted with Jan Oberhauser. He's the founder and CEO of the automation platform N8N. That's pronounced N8N, not Naden, as I had incorrectly assumed. The platform was founded in 2019 in Berlin. Jan and I chatted over the beginnings of the company, especially how he began as a visual effects artist, then a programmer, and the gaps he saw where N8N could make its mark. We chatted about its Fair Code license, how it allows companies to self-host, and the impact this has on European sovereignty, on the European tech stack, and how AI innovation is comparing in Europe with China, with the US. So I hope you're looking forward to that. But before, a quick message from our sponsor, Vanta.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority, but to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. And obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors, but they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one compliance solution, helping startups like yours get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. How? Vanta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. And the platform connects you with trusted VCSOs to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vanta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including many Y Combinator and Techstars startups, who trust Vanta. Simplify compliance and get $1,000 off at vanta.com/EU startups. That's vanta.com/EU startups.
Hello, Jan, and thank you for coming on the EU Startups podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you. I was hoping that before we begin, I always give guests a chance to introduce themselves, who they are, what their company is, before we get into the meat of the interview.
Sure. Yeah. I'm Jan, founder and CEO of N8N, a German, grew up in the south of Germany, come originally from the kind of movie space, and honestly experiences there kind of later kind of brought me to the creation of N8N. And what does N8N do in the end is also how it started, kind of we empower people. Originally we started with empowering people to build something they never thought they could build themselves. And now we do the same with AI. Like we allow people to kind of build anything from basic automations to very complex automations that include AI to have real AI agents and make it as simple as possible. And again, as powerful agents as they want to build from, again, simple to the most powerful ones. And I think we get used by people privately in SMBs, in your Fortune 500, up to government organizations.
I love how colloquially you just present it. You know, there's one would think it isn't the ginormous and successful story that it is just from the way you're talking about it. But before we get into that, I find very interesting your background, your visual effects background. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was hoping that you could talk us a little bit through that journey of you began as a visual effects artist, you moved into programming, and at what point did you see that there was a gap somewhere? I've read multiple times through different reviews that you talk about that you kept having to rewrite the same code over and over and you felt all this time wasted. So if you could kind of give us a little bit of detail there as to what was that moment that you said, there's something wrong here and I have an idea of how to fix it.
Sure. To provide a little more background, and originally when I started in the VFX space, like my job was to kind of create actual images. After a while, I got bored and I wanted to do something more technical and I became a pipeline TD. And what you do as a pipeline TD is you kind of make the life of the artist more efficient, easier, which in the end is automation. What I realized there is that the things I built was more or less the same things again and again and again, just slightly differently arranged. Like in the end, it was kind of getting data from somewhere, creating a movie out of the images, kind of sending a message, things like this, like very discrete pieces of work. And again, they were just slightly differently aligned, like the order was differently and the kind of the details what they did. But they felt like distinct building blocks. So the idea was like, if it's actually what I'm doing, it's honestly wasn't the most exciting thing either because it was very repetitive. And it felt like I wasn't able to do the best job as obviously I didn't know, like I always didn't have the full background and the people always explained what I was supposed to be building. I built something, I went back to them. They said, hey, that's great what he built, but can you change this? And then I went back on building again. I came back, had multiple iterations. And even after I was done, it was still not great because then after a while, a process changed and I had to kind of fix it again. Then I just was wondering, like, if it's actually that simple what I'm doing and there are just these distinct building blocks, why can those people that are, again, very smart, very technical, not do it themselves? And that's when I had the first idea. But honestly, back then, I didn't really solve it. It was kind of just stuck with me. It just happened then a few years later where I realized that even though I was technical and I could program myself, and I realized then, hey, even it's not great for me because, again, I kind of, what you just mentioned before, kind of recreate the same code again and again and again. And also there, it's like normally connect one API with another API. But hey, it's again, this kind of building blocks you have there as well. This is when kind of the idea about end-to-end started. It's like create a system which allows the kind of technical people like myself, like the free programmers up to kind of a level beneath that are still technical but not full-blown developers to kind of do it themselves as well. And that is when I kind of created, again, honestly, first I looked in the market and hoped there's something out there already that does that, but I didn't find anything. I then started to kind of brainstorm a little bit and then started to kind of write the first version of end-to-end, which was very basic, but again, it kept on iterating and then until I launched it, I think probably 1.5 years later.
Well, that iteration, I think, leads me to another point that's very interesting about N8N. And I want to say that the first time I saw that name, I assumed it must have been like Naden. You know, I was there thinking, how the hell do I pronounce this? I've seen you specifically tackle the pronunciation because I assume it might be kind of a point of contention for some people. But this thing you're talking about, iteration after iteration, to me goes into like this, the open source like approach you have, which I think you've referred to it as a fair code license, right? And so explain a little bit about that. What does that mean?
Yeah, maybe first about the name. It caused a lot of confusion from the beginning. So the first things I actually added to the GitHub repository was actually what the name actually means and where it came from, because it came up quite a lot, but we say N@N. And talking about the fair code license, I think that was actually also like, I think caused quite some issues in the beginning because we didn't start with the license. We actually started with a kind of Apache 2 with Commons clause, which is kind of an open source license with a modifier applied that kind of makes it not compliant with the OSI terms. And that made some people quite unhappy. And that is, again, by then later, we kind of stopped to use the wording open source, but we rather kind of coined our own term, which was fair code. And the idea behind it is more or less, it's like there are certain issues in this open source world where a lot of the value created by the product actually doesn't go back to the product to kind of reinvest it into the product and kind of make the product better, provide better support, hire more people and kind of move faster, but it rather kind of disperses somewhere else in the pocket of another organization. And so we kind of try to find a good balance. How can we ensure you build this still kind of very open ecosystem around N@N, but at the same time, I'm still able to kind of build this kind of sustainable company around it. And I think it worked out quite fine in the end, luckily, but obviously it was a gamble back then.
Sure. And then, you know, if we take this further and look at things in a wider economic, geopolitical scope, right? How do you see this affecting the European tech stack in terms of this approach to, you know, we're talking about right now, we've got LLMs of all sorts. I know self-hosting is an important part of N8N. So how do you see that kind of shaping the European tech stack? How do you hope it shapes the European scene?
Yeah, in the end, this is like kind of building this kind of open ecosystem. And I think like, if you think about like, what do we really, why is it important? Like what do we mean with open? Like I think you can see this kind of openness like in multiple parts. You can see like from this kind of code angle, like where everybody can see the code, they can fork them, they can self-host like you mentioned. but also the platform, like you can integrate with literally anything. You can use one LLM tomorrow and another one the week afterwards. You can change it very easily, the same with any kind of databases. But it's also kind of the way kind of how we operate as well. It's like we are very welcoming, like we help people to learn and we help them if they have problems. But also kind of whole ecosystem where everybody can kind of create integrations, kind of share templates and help each other out. I really think like why is it important, again, in this case, specifically for N&N, is important because we think if you really want to become the standard, which you want to be, like you have to be open. Mm-hmm. That is how we got people again to kind of run N&N anywhere from the smallest organization to the biggest one worldwide, is because like you need this independence. You don't want to be kind of locked into anything. And I think that's especially again important kind of in Europe, because like if you look out in the market, like the most dominant SaaS AI kind of products out there, or the infrastructure is all US built, it's kind of US hosted, it's kind of US governed. And with this kind of proprietary platforms, you kind of also inherit all of those dependencies. And I think like open source and our kind of fair code like lets this kind of European companies and institutions kind of really build on the foundation they kind of really control. Like it's more or less the difference between kind of renting and owning. It's like you really own it, and you can kind of decide what's important there and how you kind of want to move forward, and you keep all the flexibility there.
And security wise, and I speak from a place of ignorance completely. I know nothing about this really. I know from what I talk about in these interviews. So from a place of security, then, is that an important angle?
Listen, the nice thing is like, if you actually like, if you kind of, in this case, for example, self-host your tool, like you can literally control literally anything. Like, can somebody access it from outside of the organization? Like, what can N&N access in this case, for example? Like, it's actually quite important, especially like if you talk about some business critical use cases, especially like in some organizations they're using us. We have, for example, multiple defenses, Ministry of Defense is using us in kind of this kind of SOAR security context. Like, not being able to kind of, they wouldn't be fine with a kind of a SaaS tool that's kind of hosted somewhere. Like, they're very often needed. And I think that's kind of becomes more important also in this kind of AI world, where you kind of really kind of want to know, like, especially if you think about, like, it's a lot of it's about trust, risk, and control. Like, do you trust the party, like, with your data if it's not hosted in your own infrastructure? Like, or, like, do you maybe use it for something you shouldn't be using it for? Like, do they share it with parties they shouldn't be sharing it with? And then, obviously, that becomes the risk if they do that. But also, like, for example, if you don't self-host it and you have a SaaS platform, like, they can theoretically turn off your account. Like, it could be a simple mistake. It could be a billing issue. It could be geopolitical issues. And obviously, again, control, like, is again related to risk, because again, it's a big difference if you, for example, have your data in your own database and you can literally do anything and as much as you want to, or if it's actually behind, like, for example, saved in a CRM, where again, the company behind it could theoretically start to kind of limit the access to the data, make not all data accessible. I actually tried to build, for example, a workflow a while ago where I thought, hey, let's just build something and then try to get access to the data in the platform, and they didn't make any API available for it. I think there was actually a paid module we needed for that. And I think that's very different, obviously, if you kind of own your data. And again, that's why I think it's always a big advantage if you kind of have full control, again, especially in this AI age.
Yes. Well, and that's an interesting, you're talking here, and I think that's a fascinating part about NAN, how it's had such a broad application. And you can really use it for any. You talked about a Minister of Defense using it. So I'm curious, have there been uses of the technology that maybe have surprised you, that you didn't think, oh, I didn't really think we could use it for that, but they have?
I think N&N was always this kind of very horizontal platform. It's kind of similar to coding. So theoretically, I always knew people are going to build very crazy stuff. In the end, it's just surprising what the party used it for. And I think some things that surprised me, for example, very early on, again, we got used as a SOAR, as this kind of security automation tool, which is actually one of the the first users there was a big European telecommunication company. And again, and now again, a lot of ministries of defense are using us there. That's something I didn't anticipate originally. I also didn't anticipate like how people use it sometimes privately, like and having this, like some fun use cases. Hey, I want to go in the fitness class. Kind of once a week, it's normally booked out unless I book directly at 12 p.m. at night. So they kind of automated that. Or people use it for web scraping or kind of automating social media, media video creation and so on. It's like, it's not things like people build the same things they would normally build with code. And so again, it gives you this kind of whole breadth of possibilities. And you always see every day a new workflows appearing. If you actually look on our website, I think we have now over 8,000 templates on there, like pre-built building blocks where people can just go there and kind of reuse them. We can do things. People spend hours in building with the push of a button, adding a few credentials, and they can do the same thing.
Okay. Well, I think it's important also to look at the wider ecosystem that N8N kind of operates. And here at EU Startups, we're continuously tracking as best we can different funding rounds, different M&A, seeing how startups are advancing. And of course, N8N is kind of, you know, you're, if you don't mind me saying so, a titan when we're talking about the field, but there's other companies that are kind of, you know, innovating in that same space. And I had a quick look, and just in the past year, I was able to put together around 125 million in funding that we kind of saw in the sector of different AI tools. So I'm thinking then from your perspective, from somebody who's, I mean, you were founded in 2019, right? So from somebody who's been now in the sector for a while, I was wondering if you could give us your look as to how you see the distinction, because we're in the AI age now. Everybody's building with AI, right? Mm-hmm. So what gives to a company being successful building an AI tool, and what gives to our company just kind of disappearing in the fog of the thousands of other companies using AI?
I think there's probably multiple pieces. I think distribution is definitely an important one. Like, it makes us everything easier if you already have kind of the relationship with the customer, especially also if you maybe have their trust, especially in this kind of AI, it makes everything easier and you kind of are able to kind of move much faster and get much more adoption and kind of really make sure you can provide value there, which again is again probably one of the most important things, I guess, goes over to kind of impact. If it's not just about like kind of a nice to have, which I think a lot of AI tools are these days, like it's really about kind of the real winners are the ones that provide like when the whole business stops, if the tool would go away, like you want to kind of be there for business critical use cases and provide like real value, real ROI for these organizations. The next one is data, which we talked already before, is like, again, like the data is the thing that creates value. It's like the model is nice, but they're kind of also getting more and more commoditized, but it kind of what really matters is the context, and kind of without data, they cannot really operate. Then probably is around speed. It's like speed was always important, like as a startup generally, but I think it is kind of, the AI world is moving faster than anything else out there. It's like in the past, if you kind of found product market fit, you were fine, and now it feels like it's, you kind of have to constantly kind of think about reinventing yourself and kind of, because the whole world is changing around you, so kind of the company has to kind of change as well. And I think it's just a risk. Like, I think a lot of European companies kind of to optimize for safety and sustainability in the end, but which is very helpful. But I think that the winners are really the ones that are kind of willing to kind of have do the kind of bold moves. So again, I think, probably it's around, again, distribution, data, speed, risk appetite, I guess, and impact.
Sure. And when you look at these kind of European companies, where do you see them kind of measuring up? If you're looking at the US, if you're looking at China, where do you see European AI kind of going forward?
Yeah, I think like and again, if they between US, China, and Europe, like we are kind of, I guess Europe is definitely behind kind of on this kind of foundational models the end, but I think we're doing quite well in this kind of application layer innovation. Like the US has, like, they have the capital, they have the people, they have the compute in the end. China has like a government that's kind of really willing to pour a lot of money into it and kind of really move very fast. And I think where we can improve in Europe is probably around mainly risk appetite and ambition. Like if you look what the when you talk, when they mention big, and then US people talk about big, and then European people talk about big, there's like this whole world between it. There's like normally like a whole order of magnitude between the kind of scales we are talking about. And I think if we kind of are willing to take some more risks and kind of thinking bigger and being more ambitious, I think that would definitely allow us to kind of catch up a little bit on the kind of foundation models as well.
If we're talking about AI as much as automation, because I, you know, I want to bring that to the conversation too. There's a lot of worries now because you've already mentioned that there's some companies who, if you take away AI, their entire business model falls apart. So if we're looking at the AI bubble, which it's kind of the hot topic right now because everybody said it was going to burst. Hasn't burst. We're all just kind of waiting on our feet. Is this permanent? Is it not? From where you sit, how real does that feel? And if you're looking at companies that are ingraining NAN directly into their offering, how does that, what does that look like for you?
There's definitely a lot of money in the market right now. Maybe sometimes it feels a bit too much money. Like I think a lot of, able to raise a lot without having a lot, but I think it was historically very often times like that. But I think right now that the good thing is like there is like the underlying technology, like there's generally useful and like it's improving very fast. There's like a real opportunity here. It's kind of 100% sure like it will create like real value for people. And it's also what we see in the internet ecosystem, like what people build, they're kind of solving real issues, real problems. Honestly, often even in industries, they kind of have moved quite slow historically. And I think like, for that reason, I would say it's not a bubble. It's like, it's general adoption that we are seeing with NNN. Again, this glue of those systems to kind of connect your data with the AI and kind of become this kind of operating system there. I think that is why, I think even though there's a lot of money in the market, the opportunity is even bigger. That's why I don't think it's a bubble.
Okay. Well, then, and to shift away, because I think we spend enough time on AI and automation, I don't want to keep you too long here. I know you've also angel invested, and I also had a look over articles, and you do get mentioned, apart from NAN, that you get mentioned as angel investing in different companies. So I was wondering if you could maybe give us a little bit of patterns on what you're seeing, whether it's on investors, on companies, on what's interesting you right now.
Sure. Like pre-AI, like I always liked when people came to me that already kind of built something. Like it's also how I built NNN. Like in my previous startup, I, for example, invested a lot of time in creating pitch decks and things like that. And with NNN, I thought, hey, now let's build something great and show real traction. And then I'm sure investors will come at the end as well. And I think in the age of AI, where it's simpler than ever to literally build something, I think I expect that they already have built something. It's not just a pitch deck in the end. And I think the next thing is probably like they do something bold, something interesting that has a real opportunity out there. And they are very passionate like about and have experience in their field. Like I'm also a bit worried when people come and say, hey, we kind of analyze the market and we see a real gap there. Like I think you can probably build a successful company like that, but I don't think you build something amazing or outstanding if you kind of do something because you think there's a gap in the market rather than something you're really passionate about, because like it's a long journey. Like you mentioned before, I launched at the end of 2019, but I actually started to code beginning of 2018. So it's like 8 years later and I'm still sitting here. So if you're not passionate about it, just do it because you think there's a gap in the market. Just do it because you want to become rich or successful, anything like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think you build a successful company. You probably take the first opportunity there is to kind of exit somewhere, and then you don't build anything great. I think that's the things I'm looking for.
Okay. Well, and I had, for my final question, I'll save this for the end because it's got nothing to do with anything else that we've talked about, but it's just something that came to my mind at the very beginning. And it was, you're talking about your visual effects artist past. And that made me think about, because there's this huge, I mean, we've talked about AI. There's this huge conversation now about, you know, the use of AI when you talk about visual effects specifically, graphic design, things like that. Now, I was curious to hear your opinion on that, because you've got kind of, you have a foot in both ponds, really. And I want to know which one you leaned on.
But sorry, I mean, between what exactly? Between using AI?
Well, the use of AI in visual effects, okay. the use of AI in graphic design, these kinds of things that were seen very artistic and human in past and now are kind of being coincided with the use of AI.
Honestly, I was really surprised like how fast it happened. If a few years ago people would have told me what is possible today would become possible, I would have thought it's totally impossible. Like it wouldn't work because like things I spent back this year, like a whole team spent sometimes months on one scene and they can create the same qualities today with a prompt and 10 minutes. Yeah. That's definitely very worrisome. There's definitely like, you can see this, like you can probably see it from different angles. You can say, hey, there's a lot of risk that a lot of people kind of lose their jobs and kind of moving in the wrong direction. But you can also see it like in the end, that a lot of more people are enabled to do something that only like big studios could do. So like instead of having like being now employed at a big studio and kind of spending literally kind of weeks to kind of use some piece of the background somewhere and not adding much value there, like people kind of create their own movies and kind of, you don't really need kind of big million-dollar budgets anymore. Like you can do amazing stuff by yourself. And I think it's actually probably will be really amazing in the sense of what kind of content gets created by the people. Again, people everywhere have amazing ideas, but in the past, like they couldn't, there was no way to kind of make it actually happen. And I think because of AI, actually like it's totally commoditized. Like with $50, you can actually do a lot these days. And again, it's not just in Europe and the US, like also in Asia, in Africa, anywhere, like more and more people get enabled there. And I think it's actually, I'm quite first excited to see what all of those people are building. And second, also excited to see like how it's probably going to shift generally. Like obviously right now, like they create one series for millions of people. Like in this future world, like they can just create a perfect series about you. Like they have all the context about you. They know what you like. They have like, they can literally, while you watch, they can theoretically change the movie. Like there's so much opportunity there in the future. So definitely, I love watching movies and TV series. Not surprising with my background. But quite excited to see how it's actually going to move forward and how we're going to kind of consume this kind of content in a few years from now.
That's fascinating. I'm glad I asked because I was hoping to have an opinion on it. Well, thank you very much, Jan. It's been a pleasure to have you on. I won't keep you any longer. And I want to thank you for a great conversation.
Thank you very much for having me. And yeah, wish you a great day. Take care. Bye.
Thank you, Jan.
Bye.